It's a warm spring afternoon, and we're walking through a patch of dry grass in Sugar Land, Texas, a city about 20 miles outside of Houston. Two nearby highways fill the air with a constant hum, occasionally broken up by the sound of a plane landing at the tiny airport just behind us.
We're approaching a brand new school building, the James Reese Career and Technical Center. It's very modern, light brick, sharp angles, and floor-to-ceiling windows that students stream past on their way to auto shop and culinary classes.
But that's not why we're here. See, in 2018, a few months into building this school, a backhoe operator was filling in a trench when he spotted a bone.
Now to a developing story out of Sugar Land, where a construction site has turned into an excavation site. Crews working on a Fort Bend ISD building discovered an historic cemetery on those grounds. So far, the remains of more than 30 people have been found.
Day after day, more bodies were unearthed. Each grave was draped with a plastic tarp, and soon the whole field was covered. I know what you're thinking, and no, this is not a true crime podcast. At least not in the way you'd expect. This wasn't a serial killer's dumping ground or anything like that. But it was evidence of a particularly dark period in our country's history. Evidence I bet many in Sugar Land wished had stayed hidden.
By the end of that summer in 2018, a total of 95 bodies had been found. And immediately, everyone started asking the same question. One that remains unanswered all these years later. Who was buried here?
2 years ago, we set out to tell the story of these 95 people. Who were they? What happened to them? But it turns out that their story is just as much about them as it is about the people who've been trying to control them for over a century.
These remains do not belong to anyone other than their descendants. They do not belong to you. You don't own them. You have no rights to them.
Ultimately, this is a story about power.
There just comes a point where, as a leader, you've got to say, this is what we're doing and this is why.
Who gets it and how they wield it.
By identifying descendants, now you're bringing more people onto the table that may not agree with you. So let's really not find those folks.
I'm Brittany Martin, an independent journalist based in Houston.
And I'm Naomi Reed, an assistant professor of anthropology at Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas.
And this is Sugarland, an investigative podcast series about the 95 souls laid to rest here and the systems that buried them, presented by the Texas Newsroom.
And Fort Bend ISD officials say it's still too early to know just who is buried here. But the Sugar Land man says he believes he knows, and he says it's something he's been working to get acknowledged for nearly 20 years.
That man was Reginald Moore.
The system said you were free unless convicted of a crime. And so that's how they was able to get slavery back.
Moore, who everyone affectionately calls Reggie, was impossible to miss. He was 6'2" with a booming voice and the cadence of a preacher. When we started working on this series, his name was the one we heard over and over again.
Mr. Reginald Moore.
Mr. Moore.
Reggie.
Mr. Moore.
Reggie.
Reginald.
Reginald Moore.
That's because he spent years pushing the city of Sugar Land to acknowledge its not-so-sweet origins. Near the turn of the century, Sugar Land was home to the largest hubs for convict leasing in Texas. The practice of leasing convicts for labor was adopted across the South in the decades following the Civil War. Reggie would show up at city council, school board, and county commissioners' meetings to explain how black male prisoners were most often lent out to sugar farmers and forced to do the grueling work of harvesting sugar cane.
Convict leasing solved two major issues facing white landowners at the time. First, it provided a cheap workforce to replace the slaves they'd lost. And second, it created an environment where they could keep treating black people as second-class citizens. Reggie believed the graves found at the school construction site belonged to those black prisoners who worked and died on local sugar plantations. And he'd been saying the same for years, long before their bodies were actually found.
Every time he spoke publicly, Reggie wore this one t-shirt his wife bought him years ago on a trip to Atlanta. It's black with a portrait of Martin Luther King Jr. stenciled on the front in gold. Reggie followed in MLK's footsteps.
I have a dream that one day these free men of neglected and exploited souls would be recognized for their hard works and contributions for Sugar Land in constructing this great state of Texas in the Reconstruction era.
And his message, like his shirt, was always the same. This city and this state were built on the backs of exploited Black men. And for that, they deserve our apologies, our recognition, and our respect.
For Naomi and I, this story hits close to home. I was born and raised in Houston. I went to Texas Public Schools and graduated from the University of Texas. I've written for newspapers and magazines across the state. Actually, I've never lived anywhere else. But before these 95 bodies were found, I'd never heard of convict leasing. At first, I thought maybe that was because I was a white girl who grew up in a mostly white part of town. But the more we got into this, I heard the same from all kinds of different people. It's a pretty glaring omission from our history books.
It definitely is. I grew up sort of in the shadows of Sugar Land, next door in Missouri City. Sugar Land was whiter, it had nicer homes, better schools, the mall, better football stadiums. Missouri City felt like the lesser place to live and learn. When I grew up, I wanted to understand how kids on the other side of town understood people like me, kids from Missouri City, Black people. So at 28 years old, I started doing ethnographic fieldwork at a public high school there. For a year, I went to three different U.S. history classes and talked to 15-year-olds about what they were learning about race. I discovered that Sugar Land has needed to have a race conversation for a long time. I've been talking about this place and how Blackness, Black people, and Black history have been ignored for years. So when Brittany approached me about doing this podcast, I was game.
So we started where anyone researching convict leasing in Sugar Land would start, with Reginald Moore.
We'll move down to one public comment. Those citizens desiring to speak the public comment have signed up, and I'd like to call you up.
In the summer of 2013, the city of Sugar Land was looking to invest in some new parks projects.
Please introduce yourself, state your address for the record, and then you'll be given 3 minutes for public comment.
There were a few proposals on the table: a network of hike and bike trails, a festival site, and a sports park. Definitely not on the list, a memorial to convict leasing.
But that didn't stop Reggie from showing up to ask for one.
We'll move to the next speaker, Mr. Reginald Moore. Mr. Reginald Moore is speaking on our Agenda 4A resolution. Mr. Moore?
Yes, my name is Reginald Moore. I'm a historian preservationist, and I'm a former correctional officer with the Jester Unit.
His request might sound a little rambling, but that's just how he talked. And he opened with a pretty big ask.
Part of the money out of the bond election, I would like for them to build a museum in honor of the convict lease system.
He also wanted the city to start proactively searching for unmarked convict graves.
So because there wasn't any archaeological studies, the concerns are where these people buried. But those homeowners like to know, you know, where these bodies are they living on grave sites? So I'm petitioning the city for archaeological studies on this particular property.
Remember, this was 5 years before the graves were discovered. But Reggie just knew their bodies were out there.
I've been petitioning this for years, some 12, 13 years, so I'd like to see this book done. Well, we had a bond here included in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Thank you for being here tonight.
As Reggie said, this meeting wasn't the first time he'd made this kind of request.
The way he comes on, because he comes on so strong, gives or gave, I think, some people in their mind sort of permission to dismiss him.
This is Jay Jenkins, a white attorney originally from Iowa who also happens to be one of Reggie's closest friends and fiercest defenders.
It was almost like people, they felt like they were dealing with a telemarketer or something that they could just dismiss because he's going to come back the next time and the next time and say the same thing. And so there's no point in really addressing it.
We've learned that persistence was Reggie's calling card, and it wasn't limited to his activism.
We officially met in 1998. We went to the same church and we ended up in the same Sunday school class.
This is Reggie's wife, Marilyn Moore. She's a whole head shorter than him and has the kindest eyes behind her cat eye frames.
Even then, he was very passionate and he was, it seemed like he was in distress. So I just asked the class to pray for him.
I spoke with Marilyn on a stormy afternoon last summer. Her house is on the very edge of Harris County, just a mile or two north of Sugar Land.
And I remember one Sunday, I came in late and I had to sit next to him. And I could see him looking at me from head to toe, and it just got on my nerves. You know, why is he looking at me? Why don't you stop looking at me? And I don't know the timeline, how much later it was that he called me.
See? Persistence.
He got my number from somebody in the class and called me and left a message on my answering machine and said that, well, I wasn't at Sunday school on Sunday, so I was just checking to see what happened. I was saying, yeah, all right. So I finally called him back, and we talked for a long time.
But she still wasn't sold on the idea when he asked her out.
He asked me about going out on Friday. I said, well, usually my kids and I, that's pizza night for us. I said, well, I have to see if I can get someone to stay with my kids. That was my, I thought I was going to get out of
it. Right, you're like, oh no, yeah. Can't find anybody.
Right, I didn't look.
But Reggie kept calling, and his persistence paid off. 6 months later, they were married.
Back then, Reggie was working as a longshoreman, loading and unloading ships coming into the Houston Ship Channel. It was a job he'd had since he was 18. That is, except for a short stint in the 80s when he was laid off during an economic slump.
That's when he got a job as a guard at a men's prison in Fort Bend County. And it was there that he first started digging into the history of convict leasing in the area.
85 through 88, I think. Working in there and seeing how they were treated and those kind of things, it reminded him of slavery.
When the economy rebounded, Reggie went back to his longshoreman job. But he kept thinking about convict leasing. To better understand Reggie's quest, you need to know a little more about this place and its history.
Today, Sugar Land is one of many desirable suburbs on the outskirts of Houston. But in the early 1800s, it was home to the hottest real estate in Texas. When the father of Texas himself, Stephen F. Austin, was doling out land to the state's earliest non-native settlers, he chose this area for his homestead.
The Brazos River runs right through the city and south all the way to Galveston Bay. That meant the area had fertile soil, plenty of fresh water, and easy access to a major port.
In this way, Sugar Land is really proud of its heritage. There's First Colony Mall, a neighborhood called New Territory, Settlers Way Park, and neighborhoods and streets named something Plantation or Colonial something. But the identity this city embraces more than anything is right in the name, Sugarland.
Sugarland, the city that sugar built.
Early white settlers found the land was great for cultivating sugarcane and spent decades growing and processing raw sugar, first relying on slaves and later convict labor.
In the first half of the 1900s, basically everyone who lived in Sugar Land worked for Sugar Land Industries or its sister company, Imperial Sugar.
Imperial Pure Cane Uniform Quality Sugar outsells all others in the Southwest.
Ladies, whenever you buy sugar,
please remember this refrain.
Imperial Sugar is 100% cane, pure cane.
Imperial Pure Cane Uniform Quality Sugar.
Yes, indeed.
I can't tell you how long that song has been stuck in my head.
Schools in the area used to tour the Imperial Sugar Refinery. My mom was a teacher, and one of my most vivid memories was tagging along with her in her third grade class on a field trip there. I was probably 11. We climbed like 90 sets of stairs to get to the top. I remember being so tired and sore because I was recovering from a broken leg at the time. I can vaguely picture big vats of sugar, and the tour was mainly about processing it. But I don't remember hearing anything about the people who made it all happen, especially before the refinery was industrialized.
Yeah, growing up, I honestly didn't know there were other brands of sugar. We only ever had Imperial at home. It's got that Royal Blue Crown logo on every package with since 1843 above it.
It was here in 1843 that the first cane sugar mill in Texas was built. And thus, more than a century ago, cane sugar became the cornerstone for one of Texas' great industries, providing one of the world's vital products, pure cane sugar.
That was the story we grew up hearing. It was a family-run sugar mill that blossomed into a thriving company town. But the middle part of that story always seems to get left out.
It's the part that made the company town possible, that helped infuse millions of dollars into the Texas economy when it needed it most. That's the part Reggie dug into. Shortly after he and Marilyn got married, Reggie retired.
He had real bad arthritis, so he was able to retire based on his disability.
And he became a full-time activist.
I asked Marilyn, did he ever take any time to just chill?
He was not a chill type of person. He liked to have fun and stuff like that, but then he had this extremely serious side, especially when he really got involved full-time in convict leasing and looking at prison reform and that kind of thing.
A lot of people, myself included, wondered why Reggie stayed so fixated for so long on something that happened over 100 years ago. But the more I learned about convict leasing, the more I realized just how much of our state and nation's history is about race, racism, and anti-blackness. It formed this pattern that I can't unsee.
Yeah, and convict leasing isn't the only link in the chain connecting slavery to modern-day structural racism, but it's a really big one. On a purely logistical level, convict leasing played a major role in recuperating Texas after the Civil War. Leased convicts were forced to build railroads, mine iron, even quarry the granite and limestone used to build the Texas state capitol. But convict leasing wasn't just economically beneficial. It was a highly effective form of social control. The white ruling class used convict leasing to maintain the power imbalance in the South. They realized they didn't need to arrest every black man to keep the entire population of African Americans in line.
That's the whole idea. You scare a bunch of people into behaving a certain way, whatever that is, by creating terrible penalties for some small group of people who engage in the thing you don't want other people to do.
This is Douglas Blackman, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Slavery by Another Name. It explores the failure of Reconstruction, black codes, and convict leasing in the Deep South. During this era, prisoners from all demographics were leased by the Texas penitentiary, but black men were particularly in demand on farms in places like Sugar Land.
It was an economic need that was related to making it really clear to the millions of other black people that they needed to go along with these terrible arrangements that the white landowners were demanding of them, that they needed to agree to an ongoing subsistence life, rather than have something as terrible as ending up at Sugar Land in chains or in a coal mine in Alabama. You know, well, that's so much worse. I'll go along with this terrible situation that I'm already in. I'll go another generation or two in this. So it's a form of social control, just like lynching was a form of social control and all these other things.
For African-Americans in the post-Civil War South, freedom wasn't necessarily expected or protected, and convict leasing showed how easily it could be revoked at any time.
That's all a part of the story of how this instinctive American sense that the world is better and more stable if black people and black men specifically are significantly under the control of the state.
Just after Reggie retired, the state of Texas began selling off large sections of prison land in Fort Bend County, including the plot containing the 95 bodies we now refer to as the Sugar Land 95. In 2003, over 2,000 acres were sold to a developer to build Telfair, a brand new master plan community, which Reggie mentioned at basically every public meeting he attended. Reggie worried that the development would cover up the land's history as a plantation worked by leased convicts.
Because the state is selling all these private plantations that were part of the prison system, even plantations that became prisons.
So he got to work, tracking down historical surveys, contacting regulators, and taking meetings with city officials.
I'm here again to speak about the convict lease system.
He spent years asking the city, the county, the state, even the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to search the land for convict graves.
And we've been asking, pleading and crying 15 years to get some kill out here to do some ground penetrating radar on this site. Nobody wants to touch it.
Reggie's activism honestly became even more impressive to us when his wife Marilyn mentioned he managed to do it all with very little technology.
Never use a computer, never use a cell phone.
Ever?
He had other people
doing things, including me, for him on the computer. He did everything on the house phone. He would go to the library. He would go to the Historical Commission. He would go where Sugar Land, wherever, to find information. People were willing to help him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they saw his passion for it or wanted him to just go away. I know I wouldn't want to have to deal with him when he was in hot pursuit.
That seems universally true. His persistence wore on a lot of people, and his warnings and requests were often dismissed.
If you don't put the museum up, it's more in the real estate, and we'll put it up ourselves.
Your time is up. Thank you. Thank you for your comment.
But despite all the years of brush-offs and rejections, Reggie's work eventually paid off. So remember the new school we visited? In October 2017, the day after contractors showed up to work there, Reggie was there too. He told them that they were attempting to build on an African-American gravesite,
despite having no concrete proof of that at the time. Remember, the first bones weren't discovered until 5 months later, in February 2018.
Reggie also called the state agency in charge of safeguarding historical sites, the Texas Historical Commission.
At first, the Fort Bend Independent School District was undeterred. In an email, the district's chief operations officer said, quote, "We feel that we have done our due diligence, and work on the site continues."
But the Historical Commission disagreed. They sent a letter to the district the next day recommending they hire a professional archaeologist to monitor construction.
Reggie kept making calls, and within a week, the district had hired a team of archaeologists to monitor and survey the site.
And if you're wondering if the district was happy about being painted into a corner like that, listener, they were not.
Not at all.
Original estimates showed the monitoring work would cost the district about $45,000, and it ended up being much, much more.
So they already weren't thrilled about the extra cost. But then Reggie went and really pissed them off. 1 week after they hired the archaeologists, some Fort Bend ISD board members were at a local middle school when Reggie approached them. Dave Rosenthal served on the district's board of trustees from 2012 to 2022. According to him, that day, Reggie, quote, hijacked the conversation with his concerns.
But that wasn't what set them off. We should add that Dave Rosenthal didn't respond to our interview requests for this series. We're quoting from emails he wrote at the time. Actually, you be Rosenthal and read what he said about Reggie.
Okay, I'm Dave Rosenthal. Grail and I genuinely engaged him, took an interest in his story, and even proposed some innovative ideas related to his cause.
And all of that seems to be true. Here's part of a message Reggie left for his friend, Jay Jenkins, a few days later.
I was able to talk with their board this past Monday, and I had their attention and got their attention. And they were looking to do something with me, and they was concerned about it. They felt a plea.
But then,
when they got up to do the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance, I turned my back to the flag because of what happened at Article 13 and what happened with Texas implementing that, the cause and effect up until this day. They changed their mind about wanting to deal with me.
He's talking about the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which states that, quote, "neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States." That single caveat ushered in the era of convict leasing.
Rosenthal, the board member, was so upset by Reggie's protest that he threatened to hold the archaeological survey hostage until Reggie apologized. Here be Rosenthal again.
Okay, I'm Rosenthal. After witnessing the rude behavior of Mr. Reginald Moore on Monday evening at Quail Valley Middle School, I do not believe the district should have anything to do with this man. I understand his animosity due to his belief that some dark history has possibly been ignored, but don't drag our school, its staff, and worse, our students into this. I am considering writing a resolution asking the district to cease the archaeological study until Mr. Moore publicly apologizes to all parties individually and to the district for his actions.
Reggie said the board members misunderstood the target of his protest. He said he turned his back on the flag, not the kids.
So, need a little help, man. Need a little influence to maybe let them know what we're all about and see what could be done with that. If you could, need you to stand with me on this, or if you can give them a call, I'm asking them to go back and look at their footage that they took and see that I did not turn my back to the kids. So, but right where I'm at now, it's at a crucial point, whether or not they want to make us a part of it. But if not, then I guess I have to go back to ground zero, you know. So here I am again.
He sounds so dejected.
I know. But luckily, Charles Dupree, who was superintendent of Fort Bend ISD at the time, managed to talk Rosenthal off this particular ledge. He was like, listen, the Historical Commission basically said we had to hire the archaeologist, but even if they hadn't, it's a good PR move for us to be proactive.
Quick reminder, all of this drama happened during the first month of construction on the new school. They hadn't even found a single grave yet. This was still October 2017, and the archaeologist had just arrived to monitor construction. Rain Clark told us about it the first time we spoke on the phone.
We were actually monitoring trenching and placement of utilities and drilling piers for the foundations and everything, and saw nothing of much consequence until that day in February.
Rain's team from Goshawk Environmental Consulting monitored construction of the school for 3 months and dug trenches to search for any remains or culturally significant historic artifacts. And during that time, they found none. So they finished up their work in January and began writing up their report for the Texas Historical Commission. Then, 1 month later, the first bones were found.
When some of the workers were backfilling a trench, they saw some bone fragments. And they'd been seeing, you know, agricultural remains and things like cow bones and horse bones and sheep and pig and all that. They'd been seeing that the whole time. But there was something a little different about these bones.
I'm convinced Reggie had spies all over the city because he always seemed to know things before they were made public.
And the discovery of the first remains was no different. He left this voicemail for Jay.
Hey, Jay, this is Reg. Give me a call, man. Give me a call back as soon as you can. I've got some good news today. I'm hearing from two different sources that they've possibly found a grave out there, and the archaeologists are back out there today. So that's a major plus, you know, in trying to, you know, get everything authenticated and moving forward with the museum and the memorial and all. So, man, that's awesome now.
He was hopeful and happy. He thought finally people would have to listen to what he'd been saying all along. They'd have to acknowledge how these Black men were exploited. They'd have to face the truth, make amends, pay reparations. Finally, things would be different.
But he was wrong.
Next time on Sugarland.
They came back and they said, these are human remains. And so it was kind of very much, okay, this is real.
Hey, Jay, Reg, man, give me a call back, man. They found 20-some bodies out there at that cemetery.
The Texas Historical Commission wants the public to contact them if they think they might be descendants of those discovered at this unmarked cemetery.
The attorney said, district cannot maintain a cemetery. So what are your options at that point?
They were more concerned with getting Reggie to sign off on letting them move the bodies and continue construction than they were about actually paying these people any respect.
We have an opportunity to put a name to these individuals. This is a completely unique situation, and to not do DNA analysis, it would be a travesty.
Archival audio in this episode, courtesy of the Reginald Moore Sugarland Convict Leasing System collection at the Woodson Research Center at Rice University. Sugarland is a production of the Texas Newsroom and was completed with the support of a grant from Columbia University's Ira A. Littman Center for Journalism and Civil and Human Rights, with funding provided by Arnold Ventures, and a grant from the Convict Leasing and Labor Project. Sugarland is written and reported by Brittany Martin and Naomi Reed. Our editor is Rachel Osier Lindley. Engineering and sound design by Jacob Rosati. Fact-checking by Billy Brennan. Audio editing by Bennett Smith. Music by Jerron Marshall. Recording engineering by Jake Perlman. Production help from Rafa Fariha. The Texas Newsroom is a public radio journalism collaboration that includes NPR, KERA in North Texas, Houston Public Media, KUT in Austin, Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, and other stations across the state. Corey McLagan is the statewide managing editor. The Texas Newsroom received support for Sugarland from Frontline's Local Journalism Initiative, which is funded by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Visit sugarlandpodcast.com to learn more about everything we discuss in this series.